This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. What's the future hold? It's going to be increasingly complex, messy, and threatening, says Institute for the Future distinguished fellow Dr. Bob Johansen. His new book is Thriving in a Future of Extreme Disruption and Distributed Everything. Dr. Johansen will be the keynote speaker for the Leadership Council for Nonprofits annual Securing the Future conference next month. He joins us this afternoon, along with Leadership Council Executive Director Jenny Nyer-Berg, to talk about what the future may hold and how to prepare for it. And Bob, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And Jenny, thank you for being here too.
Thank you, Mark.
Bob, what does lie ahead? I mean, you describe it as complex, messy, and threatening. So what do you see happening in the next 10 years that leads to this?
Yeah, so the big picture is what the Army War College calls the VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And that was a term that was coined there in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, just after 9/11. And our forecast now is that's a reasonable summary of the next decade, but that it's going to get considerably worse. In other words, more volatility, more uncertainty, more complexity, more ambiguity. But the hopeful side of it is there are hopes and possibilities. And actually, I've been doing 10-year forecasting for more than 30 years. This is the most optimistic 10-year forecast and the most threatening that I've ever done.
That's interesting, the most optimistic and the most threatening at the same time.
Exactly. And a lot of it links to connectivity. We've got this radical global hyper-connectivity now that we're all becoming increasingly aware of, and it's really penetrating the whole globe. But at the same time, we're becoming more fragmented and more polarized. So it's a world of and, not or. And the big and, the big VUCA and, is that we're simultaneously getting more and more connected and more fragmented.
Now, you say the term VUCA comes from the military. How well does the military handle the future and disruption and things like that?
Much better than I thought. I'm not a military guy by background. I happened to be there at Carlisle with a group of CEOs and senior partners from Deloitte the week before 9/11, and it turned out to be a life-changing experience for me. They handle it extremely well, and the story, the way they tell it, is that this began during Vietnam when they realized that that was a war they couldn't win, and it was a shift from symmetric warfare to asymmetric warfare, and really the beginning of the kind of terrorist threat world that they live in now. So they've gotten much better at it, and they have a whole language for how to engage with it that I talk about in the book. They call it commander's intent or mission command or flexive command. It's not nearly as hierarchical as I thought.
So how well prepared is the average person for dealing with all this change?
I don't know what the average person is nowadays, but but I would guess not very well. Most of us are looking for a world where we can anticipate what we're going to do and can problem solve our way and kind of be expert in the present and kind of inch our way out to the future. That's really, really hard in the VUCA world. And it turns out it's actually easier to look 10 years ahead than it is 1 or 2 years ahead. And the trick of this is you want to get a clarity about where you want to go and then a flexibility about how you get there. So I've started now teaching at the Army War College, and I've brought executive groups there 15 times since 9/11. And I've flipped the VUCA concept. And what I say is if you look 10 years ahead, you realize that volatility yields to vision. So vision gets rewarded disproportionately, and we all have to have vision. Uncertainty yields to understanding. And this is a time when we have to listen to each other, not shout at each other. Complexity yields to clarity, and you want to be very clear where you're going, very flexible how you get there. And ambiguity yields to agility. We all have to be the equivalent of corporate athletes. We've got to be very fit and resilient to thrive in this kind of world.
How much faster do things undergo radical change now compared to, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago?
Well, the VUCA world's not new, beginning from the fact we all have to die. I mean, that's VUCA. There's been regional VUCA during world wars, during famines. So certainly we've had VUCA before. We've never had it at the global scale. We're going to have it looking 10 years ahead. And the essence of it, the big VUCA, the big global VUCA that I see, is a combination of global climate disruption, of this shift toward weaponized everyday objects and weaponized exotic items like synthetic biology, and finally the rich-poor gap that's not only stark, it's very visible. So that combination, as you look 10 years ahead, those are three global VUCA changes that I think are going to get worse over the next decade. So that's forcing us to be much more creative about how we engage with all this uncertainty.
Bob, is technology the main driver of drastic change, or does that change come from social, personal interaction?
Well, both. The way I would describe the technology, particularly the technology of connectivity, and you know, I grew up with the internet, so I was one of the early social scientists on the internet back when it was called the ARPANET, just after I finished my PhD. And you know, that kind of world, I think of it not, it doesn't determine the future, it amplifies the future. So if you're a dysfunctional organization, this kind of connectivity will amplify your dysfunctionality. If you're a great organization, it can amplify your greatness. So it's really an amplifier at that level. And then the human side of it, that's more the impact. But it's also the opportunity. You know, how do we organize ourselves? How do we find meaning in this hyper-connected world? And, you know, there's a big plus there to feel like we can connect to anybody on the planet. And our kids are growing up feeling that and thinking that, and they're right. On the other hand, it's also this very fragmented, dangerous world.
Bob, how do you and other futurists say, how do you look at the future? I mean, where do you look for signs or trends, things that you think are really going to become reality in the next 10 years or so?
You know, we look everywhere. We're global in orientation, although we're based in Silicon Valley. We're influenced by the quote from William Gibson, the wonderful cyber novelist, I guess you would call him. He said, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And our challenge is how to find, we call them signals today, because most of the present is noise. So you want to filter the signals from the noise. But we look all around the world, certainly places like Silicon Valley and Boston, Cambridge, and Seattle, and Austin. Those are important sources of innovation. But we find increasingly it's Africa. So I've got a young colleague now who spends a third of his year in Lagos, Nigeria, a third of his year in Shenzhen, China, and a third of the year in Silicon Valley. And that was consciously to be close to where the most interesting signals of the future are emerging. And a lot of that is because in places like Lagos, you're faced with very crude infrastructure in many ways, and yet you've got all this new technology that allows you to leapfrog instead of just evolve slowly the way that we have here.
So that global perspective, do you think that's the most important thing that a futurist can have?
I think global cross-cultural is a prerequisite for understanding the future, because the future is going to be, you know, if you think of demography, my PhD is in sociology from Northwestern, and you know, I was taught stratified random sampling, and what we're facing now is a demographic spectrum. So it's like spectrum diversity rather than categorical diversity. So there's, again, it's both and, not either or. And what's obvious is we're going to have this extremely diverse population that's increasingly global, whether we like it or not, and yet it's going to be harder to categorize. You know, so we're at once more connected and more fragmented. We're also on this spectrum of diversity, and people are different things at different times. You can't just do kind of gender diversity or racial diversity or ethnic diversity the way that you used to be able to do. It's more of a spectrum diversity that we're facing. But that's the starting point of the future, is how do you engage with and embrace and make the most of that diversity?
You mentioned China and other areas that are remote to the U.S. How much is their influence more amplified these days because of communications technology and digital technology and the like?
Well, a lot. And that's why we spend a lot of our time in China. With China, the scale is so large and the speed is so fast that you can understand things and get a sense of things much, much better. You know, a place like Shenzhen that began as a special economic zone, it's now one of the few places in the world where you can go from idea to manufacturer all in the same city, and it all can happen very fast. So it's you need to kind of find these innovation hotspots, and they do evolve. You know, in my career, they've shifted as new waves of technology hit, but they're so important in that global perspective. Even though, you know, in the VUCA world, there's this temptation to pull back and say, "Oh, we got to protect ourselves," and you can do that in limited ways. But we're inevitably global, so we're much better off if we just figure out how to make the most of it.
So how accurate are futurists, Bob? Say 10 years ago when they were making their predictions, is what we see today where a lot of futurists expected we would be by this point?
You know, it's mixed, and it all depends on what's your definition of success. So we keep track. We're the Institute for the Future, where I've been for many years. We're the longest-running futures think tank in the world. This is our 50th anniversary. So the first question you should always ask a futurist is, have you outlived your forecasts? And most futurists have not. So we have five times over, and we actually keep track. So over the 50 years, 60 to 80% of our forecasted futures have actually happened. But it turns out that's not the way you evaluate a futurist. The way you evaluate a futurist is that's actually the way you evaluate a fortune teller. You know, does the predicted future happen? The way you evaluate a futurist is, does the forecasted future provoke an insight that leads to a better decision in the present? So I hope some of the forecasts in my new book about extreme disruption, I hope we're smart enough to avoid those. So in that case, a success will be when that forecasted future does not happen. So the real challenge isn't predicting the future. Nobody can predict the future. If somebody tells you they can predict the future, you shouldn't believe them, especially if they're from California. but you can do a forecast, a plausible, internally consistent, provocative story from the future. That's what I do. I'm a storyteller. That provokes insight that leads to better decisions in the present. That's the way to evaluate a futurist.
Jenny, I wanted to ask why the Leadership Council wanted to have Bob come in. What did you see as being important about his message?
Well, one of the reasons we wanted to have Bob come in is because as nonprofit leaders, we get really stuck in the day-to-day operations. And it's important for us to look out and look up and move out and get to know what is happening in the world and prepare for it, anticipate it. And so the reason we picked Bob was because of his new book, The New Leadership Literacies, and what he's talking about in that book and how that applies to the nonprofit organization and any business, really. What he talks about in that book is really looking to the future, how we as leaders can change and try to avoid some of that, what he just said, that we can see. So it's important for us to invest the time in ourselves so that we can get out of the day-to-day and look beyond the messy part that we see every day.
Now, this is part of the Securing the Future conference that you hold every year.
Yes.
How big a conference is that?
Well, the conference generates usually between 275 and 350 people. Last year, we had around 350 people. And so it's a room full of wonderful, a lot of nonprofit leaders, a lot of business folks, board members, anyone interested in supporting, working for, and volunteering with a nonprofit community.
Now, Bob, in the title of your book, you talk about a future of extreme disruption. What are some examples of extreme disruptions?
Well, the three I mentioned earlier are the big ones: climate disruption, this kind of shift toward weaponized everyday objects and weaponized synthetic biology, and this notion of the rich-poor gap being extremely visible. So those are kind of the three kind of frame setting variables. Combine that with this connectivity we talked about earlier and creating what I call shape-shifting organizations, which have no center, grow from the edges, can't be controlled. They still have hierarchies, but they tend to come and go. They're kind of liquid hierarchies. So those shape-shifting organizations are great when you think about the future because they allow you a lot more flexibility. But it's really scary because the criminals, the terrorists in particular, are much better at this than the rest of us. So we're having to figure out how to create these more resilient, flexible, robust organizational forms. And then, you know, my new book's all about how do you lead them? How do you get things done in this world where you can't control? You can't just tell people what to do.
Yeah, how do you lead something that's so fluid?
So the key is to be very clear where you're going, but very flexible how you get there. That's the key. Clarity of direction, flexibility of execution.
Now, the other part of the book, the book title is Distributed Everything. So I wonder what Distributed Everything means.
So it all started with the early days of the Internet, which was originally called the ARPANET, started in 1968. The original research was done in 1964 by one of our founders, Paul Barron, and he was approached by the Defense Department and asked to create a network that would resist nuclear attack. This was in the Cold War. And in those days, networks were centralized. So if any portion of the network was attacked, the whole network might go down. So Paul and others created what was called, as it's evolved, what's been called packet switching, as a way of, when a message is sent, breaking it down into packets and then reassembling at the other end. It turns out he originally called it hot potato routing, not packet switching, which I think would have been a much more colorful, accurate name. And that made it possible to create these shape-shifting organizations. But it's taken more than 50 years now to scale and become possible. So in the book, I talk about distributed computing, and essentially the forecast here is anything that can be distributed will be distributed. So these shape-shifting organizations allow not just decentralization, but distribution. And technologies like blockchain will allow that to happen on a much larger scale. So what you're going to see over the next decade is an environment, a global environment, where anything that can be distributed will be distributed. So the real risk is not totalitarianism. You can't do totalitarianism in an increasingly distributed society. You can kind of pretend and try and have limited success, but it just won't work on a scale. What the risk is that we lose the ability to govern, that we get so distributed that we're not able to hold things together.
Is it possible, it sounds like a lot of leadership would be behind on this, is it possible for them to catch up?
It is, because it's a great time. It's too late to catch up, but it's a great time to leapfrog. So what you really need to do is not ask how can you catch up. So if you're not up with social media now, don't try, because today's social media won't be here 10 years from now. It'll be very different. Instead, ask yourself, what's your clarity? What is it you really want to do? And then how can you leapfrog to get there? Don't try to catch up. That's a loser's game.
Barry joins us now at 513-419-7100. Hi, Barry.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hey, Bob, this is Barry Feist from formerly of Procter & Gamble.
Hi, Barry.
You're on my loyal radio station, so I had to call in.
That's great.
And welcome you to Cincinnati again. Hey, I did have a question though. I'm getting more and more involved in nonprofits and in faith-based organizations, and any insight from your new book that you could share? For example, if you were just talking about distributing, how do we start distributing services and care networks based on what you're seeing coming in the next 10 years?
Yes, that's a great question, and thank you for calling in, Barry. And I should say I get to Cincinnati often because we've worked with P&G for many years, and P&G has a history of thinking about the long-term future. And this application to nonprofits and to faith-based groups, I think, is really important. I'm one of the few futurists who actually has a Master of Divinity degree as well as my PhD. So I actually have the academic qualifications to be ordained. I just never did that. But I study world religions and continue to be really interested in faith-based communities. I'm just not an advocate of any brand of religion, but I'm a student of all of them. And what religion provides is a sense of meaning or a sense of hope or a sense of purpose. And in the VUCA world, that becomes much more important. So there's a big role here. And if you imagine a nonprofit and a faith-based community in particular as a shape-shifting organization, that clarity of purpose, that clarity of meaning, that clarity of hope is the most important message. And then the ability to be very flexible in how you execute and how you deliver. As Jenny was saying, there's so many day-to-day pressures with nonprofits that they often just don't have time or energy to look longer. But the big message from my work is it's easier to look 10 years ahead than it is 1 or 2 years ahead. So there's no excuse not to do it. Go 10 years out and work on your clarity, work on your message of hope, and then organize around that.
So, Bob, you talk about, as one of your five literacies, looking backward from the future. How does that fit into all this?
Well, it links to foresight, inside action. That's the cycle. And it links to the fact that it's easier to do 10-year forecasting than it is 1 or 2-year forecasting. And, you know, I'm often asked here in Silicon Valley, how can you do 10-year forecasting? I can't even do 1 or 2-year forecasting. Well, the reason is because it's easier. It's easier. So if you go 10 years out, there's things that are obvious. And then once you articulate those, and once you develop your own clarity around those, you can work your way backwards to your strategy.
You know, another of the literacies, the voluntary fear engagement. Now, what is that about?
Well, VUCA world is frightening. And if you're not frightened by this future, you're not paying attention. And the way to engage with that is through gameful engagement. So I define that as emotionally laden attention. And it turns out the kids are better at that than we are. So this generation of young people, 22 or less in particular, grew up with gaming and grew up with hyper-connectivity in the early days of social media and grew up with an ability to gamefully engage with the future. So what it means to have voluntary fear is to have that ability to gamefully engage with the future, even if it is frightening, but to engage with that in a low-risk way. And here again, the military is way ahead of us through wargaming.
We've talked about using these in an organizational setting, Bob. How do these things help the average person in their day-to-day lives?
Well, I think we all need that discipline of looking ahead, developing our own clarity, and then kind of gamefully engaging in the alternative. So, you know, the new book is a base forecast, if you will, of the next 10 years. But there's lots of different scenarios off of that, and there's lots of different ways that a nonprofit or that an individual can engage with that future. And the key is to develop your own discipline, your own approach to the future. You know, don't let the present overwhelm you. Step out of it and get a sense where things are going and get a sense where you want to go to make the world a better place.
Jenny, give us the details for the Securing the Future conference that's coming up.
Absolutely. It's on March 8th at the Cintas Center at Xavier University's campus. It begins at 7:30 a.m. because nonprofit leaders and lots of people like to network, so we allow time for that in the morning. And then Bob will start speaking about 8:30. You can register at leadershipcouncil.us. That's L-E-A, leadership spelled as you would expect it to, and council, C-O-U-N-C-I-L.us. And so registration will be open until March 2nd.
And we have a link to that at WVXU.org as well. And Jenny, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
And Bob, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Bob Johansen, who's author of Thriving in a Future of Extreme Disruption and Distributed Everything. Also, Leadership Council Executive Director Jenny Nyer-Berg. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.